Hello, and welcome to the Inclusive Activism Podcast.
It comes from the idea that
love is an action word. So when it's time to love, you do something, and it needs to be an act. Also, it came from the idea from Martin Luther King, where he was talking about, like, if you're going to be an activist, you should be an activist for love. The purpose of this podcast in general is we're looking to learn and explore a little bit more about the concepts around diversity and inclusion, but then also how we can take the learning from diversity and inclusion and then also explore personal leadership. So we're going to get better as people, and we're going to get better at helping working with other people as well. I'm your host, Rowdy, and I will be with you for all things related to the idea of inclusion, and then also help you understand the opportunity of inclusive transformational leadership. We're going to take a deep dive into topics that are an area of concern for this community. Those of us who engage and work in this area, and those that are active anti-ists, so working against ist and ism of all spaces, is going to be our charge and some of the stuff that we work on here. Today's topic is familiar to us with those who engage with the work, and it's the idea of liberal elitism and also notions of like false enlightenment when it comes to how much do you actually know about the topic that you're talking about. I'm sure all of us have experienced before people that feel like they already know what they're talking about, and people feel like that they already know what they're doing. Liberal elitism is going to be those folks that feel like they're better than other people, that kind of look down on others. We're going to kind of look at that. And then this concept of enlightenment. So, you know, say someone's taken a class in college and they kind of understand a little bit about systemic racism. This is going to be a space where people feel as though they know it already and kind of contemn others that are in a space of learning. One of the big themes that we talk about here in the podcast is acknowledging that we are our own worst enemy in the work that we do. We're always going to be in a space of like learning, of trying to understand and grasp concepts more. And then two, when we do know something or that we're aware of something that we've learned in the past, when we kind of talk to others, we can be real jerks about that. And the fact that we can kind of come off as a bit of a dick is really huge, because when we're trying to look at inclusivism and trying to make sure that other people kind of rally to our cause, how can we make that as big of a tent as possible? And then how can we help remember that everybody's in a space of learning? One of the things that we talked about kind of like in the orientation for the podcast is how we're always in the process, we're always learning, and that pretending or acting like we're perfect is one of the biggest things that we can do that'll really get us off track. Looking at liberal elitism, we know what we know, but it's like a lot of the time it feels like we just forget someone taught us what we know, and we haven't always known this stuff. When we kind of blame and condemn others, we take on this like air of superiority, or we look at how we tend to seem as though we know everything, and don't remember that someone didn't sit down, someone was really patient with us, and that patience that someone else had shown us in the past is a space where people need us to be so they can learn from us. I mean, how can you be impatient when someone trying to learn something? You know, like I recall when I was trying to understand the importance of LGBT pride, it was really difficult because I was talking with the person that was trying to help me understand this stuff. And I was saying as a straight cis male that it would be easier for me to advocate for gay marriage if I didn't have to also try to explain away the guy with the assless chaps on the parade float. Really judgmental, right? Like, you know, this guy gets to wear assless chaps one day of the year, and here I am just being like, hey, you know, it'd be really more convenient for me as an advocate to try to tell you exactly what to do or how to be. And that person taking the time to talk with me to explain that this is a space where someone finally gets to be who they are and really be proud of who they are. And this is the one day of the year that they can kind of go out and do their assless chaps thing and be proud of who they are with their assless chaps is a huge deal, because they never are in a space where they're able to do something like that. And this is the place for that. And it's funny because I'll see myself and I think I'm so enlightened or that I understand so much.
And that's that liberal elitism concept, right? It's like forgetting that someone was really kind with you, that was someone was incredibly patient with you, that they helped explain concepts to you in a way that wasn't condemning, in a way that keep them from trying to listen to you in the future. So when we look at liberal elitism, we need to understand that everybody's feels as though they need to be forced into this performance of perfection, right? You have to be the perfect mom, you have to be the perfect grad school student, you have to get A's in everything. Nobody ever bakes cookies and burns them, right? Because nobody shows the burnt cookies picture on Pinterest. But that's life, right? Life is just a big mess. Being imperfect is so part of our experience. And us sharing this notion of perfection, or trying to strive for perfection, or showing that we are perfect all the time is so damning and condemning. And especially in the area of diversity and inclusion, where you're never going to be done. Say you knew everything and you understood it, there's still going to be a time and space where you are going to be confronted with a new idea, and you're going to mentally struggle with that, and you need to be slowly brought into a space of new understanding. That's where that personal leadership stuff really kind of ties in. It really helps us, because that's where we take the challenge of being a new and different person on ourselves, because we're always in this space of like trying to get a little bit better. And so when you're confronting this concept of liberal elitism, we need to really first look at that idea of performance perfectionism, and that acting perfect is going to be such a thing that is going to be a thing that really makes it difficult. Two, like, look at yourself. Take some time to really examine who you are and what you're doing, right? So when you're in a space where you're dealing with someone, you're working, dealing with someone, where you're working with someone that's trying to understand something in a new way, that you need to take a second. You need to be patient. You need to have your first memory go to that person that was patient with you, because that's where you are going to reach that person best. I think I, like many others, can take a lot of smug satisfaction in this notion of like, I'm going to call you out. I'm calling you out. I'm calling you out on your patriarchy. I'm calling you out on your orientationism. I'm calling you out on your classism. What is calling you out doing for them? It's making you feel really great. You're calling somebody out, right? You look really good, or your friends are going to be so excited that you called somebody out and you corrected their dumbass. That's not what the point is, right? The point is helping someone learn something differently. And when you correct someone and you don't have like this long conversation that changes someone's heart, what you actually do is you harden their heart and you anchor that person in this concept that they already had. So really looking at how we do this stuff is incredibly important. So a little bit more on that performance of perfection thing. I really feel like that's the most dangerous thing that is tied to the concept of liberal elitism. And I think too, it's just a way that keeps us from being our best selves anyway, is that we're so busy trying to look as though we're perfect, we're not spending any time with whoever we really are. It is dangerous as hell, and I really feel like that's a major problem. You'll be hearing this theme coming up quite a bit. And liberal elitism is really jam-packed with this perfection performance idea. So I know, for example, at times I will get very impatient with someone that doesn't know something. I'll call them out and I'll be like, you have no idea. You're so stupid. How could you not know this? As though I can say, you're so stupid. How do you not know? Not understanding that I'm learning stuff over and over and over again. For example, this last semester, my partner was incredibly busy. She had homework. She had been getting up about 3 o'clock every morning to do homework in the morning. She was still trying to do things around the house. And there was this concept I was exposed to called second shift. Second shift is like a space where women feel as though they need to start cleaning, cooking, doing dishes, stuff like that around the house. And I've always cooked. I've been single enough that I needed to learn how to cook for myself. So I would cook dinner, but I would find myself sitting on the couch not doing anything when it was time to do dishes. I just wouldn't do dishes. By not doing the dishes, I was forcing my partner to into this second shift concept when there was time that would have been better served in other spaces. So if I'm not understanding second shiftness with my whole enlightened, you know, male feminist deal, how the hell can I get pissed at someone else that's learning themselves, you know? How the hell can I be like, you're mansplaining to somebody else with smug satisfaction and call them out in that moment when I'm still in a space of trying to learn about how to be a good partner to my busy, stressed out partner? And it's like looking at things in that way that I think is so important. It's that understanding that when you don't take the time to have a long conversation that explains why someone should do something, why they should care about a concept, why they should change their hearts and the ways that they see things. Because I'm not trying to get someone to talk different. I'm trying to change their hearts about a topic. And if I don't change someone's heart, what I end up doing is actually hardening them. And then, am I even doing what I care about anyway? Or am I just trying to look cool in front of my other friends who get it? That's where we gotta really look at it. Like, are we being inclusive or are we just enjoying being right? So when we look at this concept, I think a big point that happens when we look at like liberal elitism specifically is there's a finger pointing that happens, right? So we kind of point out boogeymen out there, right? Is it boogie persons? I don't know. I'm still learning, right? But there's gonna be a boogie person of any privileged identity, right? So when we look at someone that needs to learn or understand something, the real damning thing about privilege is you're blind to the benefit that it gives you. And so when it's time to point fingers, I think we need to best, the fingers will be best pointed when we point them at ourselves first. When you point them at someone else, it just makes them feel as though you think that they're a jerk and a dick and they don't care about you. Whereas when I tell a story about how I'm making mistakes, or when I tell a story about how I'm still in my process of trying to learn this stuff, I become so much more approachable. I think I become a person that you'd want to listen to because you can see that I'm working through it too. And that it's hard and it's not easy to do. So if you're going to be a critic, you should endlessly critique yourself and not so much critique others. When it's time to show someone another way to think about something, tell them a story about how you struggled with the concept first. Tell them about the time when someone had to gently correct you and tell them what it meant for them to take, you know, half an hour, a series of meetings to explain this thing to you and why you chose to change. I think that will be much more effective than just calling someone out. We'll look at this concept a little bit more about how we move from calling out to another concept that I've heard of called calling someone in later on in the podcast. I think another place where liberal elitism really gets deeply entrenched to our personalities and the way that we view and then the way that we see the world is that we only hang out with people that get it, right? Are the people that understand what we already know. So we spend no time with people that don't know or don't understand things. And so what we find ourselves doing is getting these intellectual pseudo-arguments about a concept that we both agree with. And so I'll say something like, oh, hey, here's my opinion about something. And then someone will voice their slightly different idea about the exact same thing that we're talking about. And we're really just agreeing with each other and kind of like, in a party of like smug knowingness instead of actually like challenging ourselves. These pseudo arguments is referred to as like an echo chamber. I hear the echo chamber concept referred to with conservatives, but really echo chambers happen when you're only around people that see and understand the world like you. So if you don't want to be in an echo chamber, you need to spend time with people completely different than you, who see the world in a completely different way than you. And two, it needs to be in a very specific way. So, right, if I want to understand women, I can't just be like, well, I've got like three women friends who I hang out with in normative male spaces, right? I need to go to feminist spaces. I need to be the only guy in the room. I need to sit up, I need to shut up and sit down and just listen to what they're telling me to understand the world in a new way, to hear about this second shift thing that will help me understand something differently. So it's not enough to have a black friend. You should have more than one black friend. If you don't know more black people, you need to go make more friends with more black people. Because the fact that you have a black friend is weird. Like if no one's ever told you that it's weird that you have a black friend, I'm here to tell you, you need to go make more black friends. But then two, spend time with black people in black spaces. Go to black church, go to a Black Lives Matter meeting. Go to a space where you're the one person of difference and be in the space of blackness to understand blackness. Because when you just are in regular normative spaces with other black people, they're having to conform to the norm in the same way that you have to with your marginalized identities. You need to go to a space where it's mostly them and it's mostly that point of view. So, you know, with me, I need to spend time with mostly feminists. With me, I need to spend time with mostly black folks to understand what blackness means and how that is articulated to me. But you need to take the time to have patience with someone. You know, you weren't fixed overnight, and you were difficult to fix, and you were somebody's jerk, you were someone's pet project. You took forever to come to a new realization, and we need to take the time, the same type of time, with someone else so we can help actually bring them into a new meaning. So kind of in summary, we need to understand that we can be jerks about this stuff. Two, you're going to need to point the finger at yourself. You're needing to talk about how you took time to understand. You need to talk about your struggles with things. You want to talk about you first and not talk about others first. You talking about you before you talk about someone else help makes that a little bit easier for them to accept that stuff. Get outside of your echo chamber. Like, stop talking with friends who already understand stuff. I mean, it's great to get along with people that understand the power and opportunity of inclusion, but at the same point in time, you need to spend some time with people that don't understand stuff. If you just hang out with people that think like you, you're not going to change anybody's thinking because you all think the same anyway. And then two, you'll never think differently because you're not around someone who thinks differently than you that will challenge you anyway. So being in new spaces and not in that echo chamber is going to make a huge difference. The last concept that I really want to dig into here is the idea of ism enlightenment. So ism enlightenment is being around someone that feels as though they get it and they understand stuff. And so what they do is they become the critic. To kind of like dig into this idea of the critic is understanding that, like, or feeling as though you're this outside perfectionist that can critique other people is dangerous. You being a critic means that you're also on the outside of a movement. You're outside of someone actually doing something, because a critic is inherently not part of the process. They are outside of this process. A critic cannot be an activist, because an activist is in the moment doing things. They're not being inclusive. They're not being an inclusive activist. They're not changing the world in any way. They're just pointing out errors and not even offering solutions. So I want to read a quote to you that kind of talks about this concept of being a critic, right? What is a critic? What does it mean to be a critic? What does it mean to be looking always from the outside, and what are the effects of something like that? So this quote comes from Theodore Roosevelt, and I tried to change some of the language in that so it's more inclusive, because he does use man, he pronouns in it, so bear with me. It is not the critic who counts, not the one who points out how the strong person stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the one who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up short again and again, because there's no effort without error and shortcoming, but who actually does strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, great devotions, and spends themselves in a worthy cause, who at the best knows at the end of the triumph high achievement, and who at worst, if they fail, at least fail while daring greatly, so that their place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. So see, when we look at that, we see just this person in the crowd critiquing everything that someone actually doing something is doing. I mean, what a useless standpoint that is. I mean, there's a point for critique, right? I think critique can be important, but critique is not action. It's the evaluation of action. So really what's happening is you're just saying how something could have been better while actually doing nothing. Yet we hold this critic role up because a critic is perfect, right? I mean, they could critique better potentially, but at the same point in time, you can't critique a critic's action, because their action is a critique of action. And I understand, right, in this moment, I'm critiquing a critic, so I understand meta how odd this is. But at the same point in time, like, this holding up of critiquing and not doing is just also the opposite of inclusive activism, right? I want to talk about activism because I want to talk about doing. You have to have evidence of your anti-ism to say that you make a difference in some way. Otherwise, you're not making a difference and you're just talking about something that somebody else did, which does nothing. And that really hits on that notion of enlightenment, right? Like, yeah, I get it and you don't, and I'll critique you when you make a mistake, but I don't go advocate for poor people. I don't advocate for Black Lives Matter. I don't push against patriarchy. Like, you don't really do anything, right? You just talk about when other people do stuff wrong and do nothing yourself. So I want to kind of give you a little bit of a story about me and this and how I try to do this in a good way. So I am Christian, so that's one of my privileged identities. So always when we're looking at this type of thing, we're going to be wanting to look at a privileged concept. So I try to manage my outward excitement of the holiday season, because I understand that many people are incredibly inconvenienced by the oppression of Christmas. Because, I mean, seriously, it's everywhere. And it's funny, because we want our day off, but we sure want to go to the movies that day too, right? But as I come to learn and understand things more, you know, I've changed my vernacular and I don't tell everyone Merry Christmas. Now, if a church, I'm going to tell people Merry Christmas, because it makes sense, because I'm a church, right? We're all Christians, we're in group, Merry Christmas works there. But I've learned that Merry Christmasing someone's Hanukkah, someone's Kwanzaa, someone's Diwali, I mean, so many holidays during this type of season, that I alienate folks because the Christmas hegemony that exists in the world, there's so much Christmas out there all the time, and people are dealing with this all the time, and it's this constant reminder that you're on the outside looking in, and you're not part of what the normative valued group is pushing at that moment. It's the way that I've learned to change my language. But now you see this manifesting in a really negative way, right? Because everybody's like saying, don't say Merry Christmas, don't say Merry Christmas. And they just jump on people, right? No, it's Happy Holidays. Well, okay, what did that do for someone? How did they learn differently? How did they come into a different space of different understanding with you just saying like, don't say Merry Christmas? They don't learn. They don't understand something new. They just got yelled at for trying to share their excitement of a holiday, and you didn't explain why you came to your new space. So when I talk about changing stuff, I'm not trying to call people out anymore. I'm really trying to call them in. And when we talk about calling people in, it's to call them to be more inclusive, like you've learned. Or even when you show yourself willing to be critiqued, they can call you in on other things because you're open to that type of thought. You will also become a new ally to other people in that way when you're willing to show how you're willing to be called in as well as calling others in. It's not telling people what to do. It's telling them why you should do something or consider something differently. Because at the end of the day, you don't want someone to just say something the right way around you. You want them to think and understand a better way that allows them to be more inclusive. And so I'm not just trying to change my outward language for people in my presence. I'm trying to change my thinking so I do the small things in another way so they do feel more welcome and comfortable in my presence. You see how that personal leadership stuff comes out in there? I'm always willing to look at what I'm doing and how I'm seeing or performing in the world and willing to change that to make it so it's a little bit easier for someone else. I wanted to tell you another story that happened recently, and it was around the problem of the traditional Thanksgiving narrative. I tried to be really kind and gentle because it was someone that I had a relationship with. But they had sent out a poem that was talking about pilgrims and Indians, which is, for those that know, difficult because pilgrims and Indians really didn't sit down for a feast together so much. It was celebrating the killing of another set of Native Americans afterwards. So this feast of celebration was because they basically extinguished one of the local tribes. And so I found myself with someone at my work that had sent an email, and they were trying to talk about the value of pumpkins and native food and stuff like that, but it had some of that Indian pilgrim narrative in it, and so I needed to push against that. So how did I do it, right? Did I send a reply all and be like, no, you need to know that it's not like Thanksgiving and that the Indians and pilgrims didn't do this thing? that's not going to help. That's not going to change someone's heart. I sent a personal email and I said, hey, so you know, like, this narrative can be offensive to some Native people. You know, Native folks have to deal with all the time that Thanksgiving wasn't necessarily this sitting down and sharing of meals and ideas and cultures. It was a celebration of the killing of the culture of Native people. Now, Thanksgiving is a concept I'm a pretty big fan of, especially in dominant American society. The idea that we can take a day to just sit back and be thankful for the things that we have, I think is really great. But at the same point in time, the narrative of the Pilgrims and Indians is troublesome. So I told this person in a personal email, and then I followed up with a phone call. And I said, you know, I'm sure you didn't mean this in any negative way. And the only reason I even broached this conversation with you is because we're friends. And I feel like I can have this conversation with you and share it with you. And it went really well. The person unfortunately felt horrible about, you know, what had happened. And I tried to explain, hey, it's a mistake. It's not about the mistake. It's about knowing and doing differently. And the fact that you can be an open enough person to be willing to receive this information and consider changing is really the thing that I appreciate most about you. And it just went really well. It was a great conversation, and we're actually closer now from having had that conversation than we would have been even if I had avoided it. I'm thinking that's the way that we need to talk about those things and share that stuff, to find ourselves not to be in the space of like ultimate judging or putting other folks down in a different way. So now I understand that there's a critique of this notion of liberal elitism. I'm aware that people are going to approach me and they're going to say, so I'm not always patient. I've been teaching people about this all the time. Why does it always need to fall on me as a person of a marginalized identity to have to explain something to someone else? I get that. It's true. That sucks. And two, there is an exhaustion that comes from being in a space where you are going to be combating ism all the time. It really takes a lot out of you. This notion of that we always have to be sensitive to people with privileged identities and I'm sick of their fragility. I get that. I mean, all of that stuff makes sense. And it's real and it's there and it's something you have to negotiate. What I would say in response to that is, would you rather hold on to those things, or do you need to look at what the cost of making change is? Are you willing to look at what you need to do to speak with people of privileged identities to make them change, or are you too exhausted to do the work? And that takes a tough, hard look at yourself. And you got to answer that question for you. I can't answer that for you. History has shown that unfortunately, it does fall to people from historically excluded groups to educate with those with privilege. But at the same point in time, all of us are both marginalized and privileged at the same time. You can't exist as only a targeted person or only a privileged person. We have both of those things in us. And you gotta recognize that someone has educated you with part of your privileged identity. And I don't care how many layers of marginalization you have, you still have a layer of privilege within you. And that's where we need to look and do the work. You need to spend some time with your privileged identity. Remember how hard it was for you to see the invisibleness of the benefits that you received. And you need to understand that this is what it costs to change. It just costs this thing. And if you're too tired, so don't do it that day and rest. Or if you're too emotionally damaged from some ism that's happened to you recently, then don't do that now. But you gotta gear back up for this fight and to attempt to do these things this way. Because as of yet, in my life, I've never seen a protest group and a counter-protest group that was yelling back and forth in one another, where someone dropped their sign, walked across, and joined the other team because they feel like the yell, the scream, the chant make the difference and actually change their minds. It's a sit down, it's a coffee thing. This is not something you can do over social media. If you're gonna try to do this over social media, I think you're wasting your time. When people disagree with me, I say, let's sit down, I'll buy you lunch, and let's talk. And I'm usually the one that's trying to give, because I'm basically asking them to change, to join me in inclusive activism. And so that's the cost. Another thing I think we really need to keep into account is that there's the 14%. According to Marilyn Loden and her change model, you gotta go where the opportunity lies. And there's going to be 14% of the population that will choose to never change. Don't waste your time on the 14%. The 14% is going to be different based on who you're connected with, who you know, what kind of appeals you can make. What might be a 14% person to me might be a pragmatist to someone else. It's the right tool for the right job. If you find yourself in a space where you are dealing with someone who's in that 14%, that traditionalist that's just entrenched, that's never going to change, then just aim different. Find another person to try to work with. And understand, this is a symbiotic relationship. This is a give and take. This is a work with. So maybe use one of your privileged identities and one of their marginalized identities to try to find a space where it can be a give and a take, where you're trying to learn from them and where you're trying to teach from your point of view. And remember that this person might be in a different spot based on Marilyn Lowden's model, right? There's going to be the innovator, which is the person that realized the idea first. That innovator is only 2.5% of the population. They could be a change agent and really receptive to change. They could be a pragmatist, which is about 35%, or they could be a skeptic, which is another 35%. So try to get a sense of who is this person, where do they sit, and how willing and open and receptive to change are they, and how can we help to craft this message in the best way possible? And remember, weren't you made enlightened by one patient person's conversation with you? That's what made you like be someone that would want to tune into a podcast like this. We got to remember, we were all babes and someone taught us once. We got to like take that time. We got to remember that we're always learning. We got to remember we're always in the place of coming to new understandings and trying to come to a new way of seeing and understanding the world. To me, I really feel like this boils down to, would you rather look cool and perfect and show off to your friends that already understand stuff? Would you rather look self-realized? Would you rather look enlightened? Or would you rather actually make a change? And that's got to be your focus. What's the thing that you want to take the time to really look at? Is it looking good? Or is it doing the deep inner work to create the character necessary to be the person that is good? Showing off in front of other people that get what you understand doesn't do shit to change the world at all. Actually taking the time to really look and make appeals that change people's hearts and connect with other people empathetically is where change happens. Remember, leadership is an active process. It's not just when you are doing your work, and it's not just when the world's doing the work. You got to be doing your own work, and you got to be doing the world's work in the community. You have to be in a space where you're making those differences. There has to be an active push to what you're trying to do. It can't all just be thought, and it can't all just be awareness. You need to have evidence of what you're doing. You have to be actively anti-racist. You have to be able to show evidence of your active anti-racism. You have to be an active anti-sexist with evidence of your anti-sexism. You have to be active anti-classist. You have to be active anti-orientationist. You have to be able to show evidence of your work and places where you're doing the advocacy to make the change you're hoping to see. Because just knowing stuff is the same thing as not knowing stuff, because you're not doing stuff. There needs to be evidence. And unless you can show that evidence, you're just not in a place where you're making change. You're not an inclusive activist and you're not doing the work you need to do. And it's a constant call and it's difficult and it's hard to pull up your big person pants and do the stuff that you gotta do. But when you make that difference, when you change someone's life and when you help them see something in a way that they never understood, it's worth it. And that's the things that kind of keep us going. And so do that stuff. Take care of yourself. But otherwise, that is my time. This is going to be one of the first Cygnus original podcasts. So right now, I don't have any callers. I have no idea when I'll get any callers. But if this made you think something, if you have a question, or if you have a critique, which I'm sure we're going to have critiques, let me know. I'm certain I will be hearing from potentially alt-right people in the future, and that'll be some interesting things. You can call me at 860-576-9393. Again, calling the Inclusive Activism Podcast and Rowdy is 860-576-9393. So this is the place to talk to me, to ask me some questions, to ask me about scenarios and how I react to stuff, What I'll probably do is try to give you my first reaction as I'm hearing it, so I don't have the thoughtful response where I sound super perfect. I'll make a mistake with you on the podcast, and I will give you my first response. And if it's something that's really deep that I think deserves some thoughts, then perhaps we can make that a podcast in the future. So you can help make this an active space where we're kind of giving and taking. I should have the capacity to play your voicemail on the podcast, and I'll respond to what you say. As much as possible, I'll try to use inclusive language. I know I'm working on it too, but we'll put in what you got there. And then two, if you're interested in booking me and understanding how to bring the power of inclusive activism to your organization, you can always do so at Rowdy, R-O-W-D-Y, Duncan, D-U-N-C-A-N, @cox.net. And then two, if you want to learn more about this organization, what we do, why we podcast, you can do that at www.inclusiveactivism.com. And that's been our time today. I'm looking forward to hearing from you in the future tomorrow. And be an inclusive activist for love. We'll be right back.